Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Mike Malott, Jack Spencer, Jacob Kanzler, and Andrew Bitely has decided to come back, but you didn't bring bread. What the heck is going on? I thought you were bringing bread.
I didn't bake yesterday, Kyle. I'm sorry.
What? You had the whole Super Bowl day to do it. Didn't you have some bread or something that you had to bring to a party?
No, didn't leave the house. Did anyone even watch the Super Bowl, Kyle?
Boo!
Did anyone watch
Boo
the Super Bowl?
Boo to you, Andrea. Of course. Everyone watched the Super Bowl, didn't they?
No.
No, I didn't watch the Super Bowl.
You're
in the wrong room to ask that.
Oh, question. My God. This is sad. But that still doesn't excuse you for not bringing baked goods like you said you would last time. But we invited you anyway. I took the risk. And even cookies, are the easiest thing in the world.
I made cookies last week and I burned them, Kyle.
What? And you're
burned
baking
cookies.
You made this huge bun or whatever that you stuck out of the oven. You burned cookies?
I burned cookies, Kyle.
They're the easiest thing in the world to make.
They are. But
I made
burned
them when I was 10.
Burned cookies, Kyle.
Oh, my God, Andrew. This is a catastrophe.
You can ask my husband. I burned cookies.
What kind were they supposed to be?
Chocolate chip.
So you like cooking, but you don't want to eat it. Is that the idea? Is it sort of a...
Maybe this is really a deep dive into my psyche. I know that eating all the baked goods I've been making is not good for my figure. So I burn them now.
That's a good strategy.
Well, we're getting deep into the psyche of Andrew Bitely. That is not on the schedule here of what I was going to talk about, but this has gotten certainly very interesting. All right, well, we're going to be talking with a little later in the podcast the new chair of the Michigan Democratic Party. That's Lavora Barnes. She spoke with us for a couple minutes after her election as the next chair. Also, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib talked with me after the 13th Congressional Caucus, which she was at. First, guys, let's talk about the news, I think, coming out of Friday. We had a couple things that I think is worth talking about. The first one is we're going to go to trial, presumably, over these redistricting lines and whether we're ever going to redistrict because, I guess, our congressional and legislative lines were gerrymandered. Mike, are we ever going to redraw these lines?
I think it's going to get tied up in court forever. And you got the redrawing coming around in 2020, so what's the point?
But if these lines were gerrymandered, Jack, then it seems like they should all be redrawn then, shouldn't they?
Well, then you have the problem of, are the new lines gerrymandered the other way? I just think you probably have the Republicans have the ability to keep bringing up enough things in court to punt this thing way down beyond the point where it's no point, there's no reason to do it anymore because it'll be 2021 or 2022.
Some judges could take charge here, though, Andrea. Judges could say, by golly, these lines are not following proper standards, whatever those standards could be. Legislature, you've got until September 30 to redraw lines, or we're going to do it for you.
Not a chance it happens. It's going to cost an arm and a leg to do. It's going to affect surrounding districts. Each surrounding district is going to end up as part of litigation. And the one thing to keep in mind, if these lines were so gerrymandered, then why is the state house so much closer now? Why did Mike Bishop lose to Alyssa Slotkin? Are the lines really that gerrymandered? And I think you're going to see a lot of the public say that when they see the legal bill that is coming around, and that they know in a few years we're going to have completely new lines anyway.
Argument that Mark Brewer, who is the attorney for the League of Women Voters here, is something called the efficiency gap, Jacob, which we've talked about quite a bit. And it's the efficiency gap argument that he really wants to get legitimacy for. And I think that's why he's pushing forward with this, because the efficiency gap is basically mandating going down the line that we take into account how competitive a district is before they go out. And as we go into the 21 redrawing, he wants to make that maybe more the top priority than making sure everybody's in the same county or the same township. And that's why I see this thing not dying.
Maybe the benefit here of the trial for the folks that are pushing forward is, even if the lines aren't redrawn for the 2020 election, which is clearly what the consent agreement put forward by Jocelyn Benson, the League of Women Voters, was going for, is that if you can try this out in the legal system to kind of say, like, what are the expectations for avoiding this issue of gerrymandering? The efficiency gap, the number of wasted votes, the number of, you know, votes that weren't needed for the winning candidate, is that something that's going to kind of come out as a judge-mandated or judge-guided standard when we go to redistricting in 2020, which, in addition to, we're going to have a whole new process after 2020. So whether that folds into the Independent Redistricting Commission's charge to draw lines too, I mean, it's going to be interesting to watch.
I mean, that's an interesting theory to come up with on the, you know, let's make it more competitive. But I don't know what the basis is of that. If your hometown is 80% Republican, you got to cut it in half so that it becomes more 60% Republican. It's an interesting theory if you're doing it for entertainment purposes, but I don't understand the constitutional argument.
And how can you actually have truly competitive districts in certain parts of the state? I mean, you're going to see very bright red pieces in certain areas, very dark blue pieces in certain areas. Are you going to really chop up the city of Ann Arbor, per se, or Detroit to make them more competitive to Republicans? The argument just doesn't hold any water.
When you look at this redistricting committee, they're supposed to be looking at communities of interest. So when we're doing this in 2021, they're trying to put together communities of interest, but that conflicts sometimes with making things competitive and reducing the efficiency gap. I mean, you could take, let's say, parts of Lansing and spread it out into Charlotte, but is that really a community of interest? Yeah, it might have all of a sudden gotten very competitive, but in the process, you're now mixing Charlotte together with, let's say, the south end of Lansing, and does that make any sense?
The two populations aren't similar. I mean, we have city dwellers here in Lansing, you know, myself included, and then you have, you know, people out in Charlotte who are more concerned with agriculture issues as opposed to issues such as infrastructure that we're seeing in cities.
There's a lot of factors to be weighed, and I don't know what is going to win out. I mean, maybe at the top of the list you have obvious federal and state laws, and then you have the APOL standards, which is the line breaks of communities, and then now you're talking about communities of interest, and then you also want to, well, also, by the way, these can't be gerrymandered. And the question is going to be, are all those going to make the cut in terms of prioritizing how you draw lines?
Or in what that prioritization list looks like. I mean, because all of a sudden, communities of interest could jump over the APOL standards. Maybe that all of a sudden becomes more important, right? So even if you've got a community of interest that breaks a bunch of township lines, well, this is the way it looks, even if it's kind of funny looking and now you've got, you know, Vive Township with two state house districts.
This occurred to me, but of course I have a very devious mind. But does this redistricting thing here somehow run interference for what the Republicans may have wanted to do with the commission as far as delaying that ultimately in some way, getting some legal battles against that going? If you've got this thing playing out here, does that make it easier for that commission to just step in when they're supposed to?
The other thing I wanted to bring up here before we go on to the Democratic convention, Jacob, you did a story on Friday dealing with some problems up north in trying to get services to individuals who need state support for heating and food. Give our listeners a little background on that.
This is actually one of the plans that came out of the merger, is how can we, you know, deliver
what,
service.
What merger?
The DHHS merger.
Okay.
We refer to it as the merger.
The merger. The merger of all mergers.
Yes. So in trying to better serve the people as opposed to cases, the state has come up with what's called a universal caseload. And there's two main components of this. It's one is we're moving from a system where a caseworker owns a case from beginning to end. Instead, it's more like, for lack of a better term, an assembly line where you have teams working on a case, certain aspects of it. The other piece of this is for the public, there's supposed to be one phone number you call to handle everything. However, that's kind of the issue I've been hearing the most, is that the phone number has been kind of the problem both on the client side, on the provider side, and also on the state worker side, where someone described state workers turning from social workers into telemarketers, where they're getting jammed up with calls, cases are being left behind, things that are supposed to be taking place in 30 days, 45 days, it could be going even longer.
So basically people aren't getting their services, or yeah, it's getting delayed, so people aren't getting their food or their heat in a timely manner.
Yeah, and that's the concern. What some lawmakers have told me is that we haven't been able to find that case where someone is like living in the cold for like 2 months kind of thing.
And it's because they got friends to take care of them.
There's other you know, things in the social, in the safety net in terms of churches and community providers, but it's putting a strain on the entire system, and it's definitely something we're hearing a lot from different parties up north, where this new process is being rolled out.
So we were consolidating things to try and make things more efficient, but in trying to make things more efficient, things are getting inefficient.
Yeah, and what I've been hearing is that the solution, from some people's opinions, is the solution you've heard before, is that we just need to hire more workers. And that's something that is not always politically feasible or financially feasible to do.
I think the problem with this, if you think about it from the point of view of the average citizen in that circumstance, is when you're in trouble or something comes up, would you rather call an anonymous 800 number or would you rather call Mary or John?
Mary or John, your caseworker.
Yeah, and that's another thing we've been hearing, is that people have been telling me, like, I knew who to hold accountable. I knew my caseworker, and now they're telling me I can't call them. That caseworker doesn't even have voicemail. Like, I got to call this number. I'm on hold for who knows how long. And then I call someone that's like 90 miles away and they have to get caught up in my case. And so when you get down to these like practical effects, it just doesn't sound good from that perspective.
Andrew, you were in state government pretty recently. What do you think is the most likely scenario to happen to this? Is that we try and plow forward with this new method to try and make it work, to try and jam that square into the round hole, or is there a chance that we retract back and say, you know what, we gave this a whack, but it really didn't work out?
I'm still trying to understand why Governor Whitmer kept the department combined. And I think the sheer volume that MDHHS has led to many an issue. And it sounds like we're seeing an issue where people are just on an assembly line, and really that doesn't work for the average person. I know if you or I are having a rough day and, you know, something tragic happens in our family and we call 911, we expect to get the answer, you know, right away. But calling DHHS, whether it could be, you know, a child abuse situation or no heat, you want that personal contact. You want that individual touch. Now, the question is the cost for this. You know, how is the state of Michigan, how are taxpayers going to pay for more staffing at MDHHS?
The understaffing of DHHS has happened for so long, mm-hmm. it's almost just become standard and accepted that we're always going to have some kind of backlog, and it never really has that human face attached to it. There's just some poor folks out there who just can't get their services, but eventually they do.
Well, the Lansing State Journal last year did a really in-depth piece on Left Behind by DHHS and talked with families and saw the caseworkers who were, you know, on maternity leave or on sick leave or, you know, were transitioning into a new role, still had cases assigned to them. I'd be interested to see if that's still the situation at MDHHS or how the new administration is working to improve that and make sure that doesn't happen again.
Well, we'll follow along and see how that goes. The governor was at the Michigan Democratic Party convention over the weekend. Lavora Barnes was elected the new chair. I got to say, guys, I was pretty impressed by the number of people who were at this event. This was Detroit, and I know it was pretty darn cold out leading up to the event, but I've got to say there was around 3,000 people. They say 2,850 delegates, and I think that was probably very accurate. A lot of enthusiasm out there, even though the only thing you were really voting on was party chair and vice chair, and even those weren't really strongly contested. It seemed like the establishment and the unions all got behind their particular slate, and that was all there was to that. But interesting that there was as many people as there were, and not a lot of visibility for presidential candidates. And I know that it's still early, people are just announcing and whatever, but I didn't see a presence from really anybody outside of Elizabeth Warren had a little pamphlet that a supporter was handing out, and I saw some Bernie shirts. Is that surprising, guys? Or it seems like when I go to Republican conventions, the folks are already well on spot, and you've got tables and volunteers and people wearing shirts. I didn't see that, which is, I found a little weird, Andrea.
It's different, I think. The Dems have a huge number of candidates every day. I feel like we hear another candidate dropping their hat into the race. I mean, we have the mayor of, what was the city in Indiana?
South Bend. Yeah.
Pete Buttigieg, I believe, is the correct pronunciation. You've got...
This is the mayor of South Bend?
The mayor of South Bend, Indiana.
Okay.
Yeah. I only paid attention because a local Lansing city councilman here, Peter Spadafore, I always in my head kind of thought, oh, you know, there's only one city councilman named Pete, and then we have now running for president a mayor of a town. But this weekend you had the congressman from Hawaii jumped in the race. Got the senator from Ohio, Sherrod Brown, is running around Iowa right now with his his journalist wife. They're all trying to make something happen. It is interesting because Michigan really is such a purpley state. You know, we transition back and forth every 4 years now, you know, flip the cycle a little bit. So I'd be interested to see if as we go through the year, we don't have a stop-in from Elizabeth Warren or from Bernie Sanders or when Howard Schultz will make his appearance here in Michigan.
Oh, yes, I'm sure. He's gotten such a great reception.
My question for you, Kyle, from covering the Dem convention was, how was the whole establishment versus progressive divide? I know that was a big theme last time a bunch of Dems got together for the nominating convention.
I didn't really see much of that. The Progressive Caucus was pretty muted. They had a slate ready to go as far as who their next leadership team was going to be. And there wasn't even a battle for chair for Progressive Caucus. That was already slated. And I didn't see a lot of tension there. And maybe it was because the candidate that everyone kind of coalesced around was so well liked and respected by everyone. It didn't seem like you could walk 5 feet without running into somebody who said, yeah, Lavora Barnes helped me with this, or Lavora Barnes did that. And, you know, the folks that were supporting Lisa Dorado, who was really the only other real candidate running, were folks in Western Wayne County who had experienced such a huge change in that last election that I think they thought that they had done something very special there and they wanted to share it statewide. But outside of that, there wasn't that tension that you might expect or that you saw in the last election. And that was one of the things that I kept hearing about why they were happy to have Lavora Barnes is because she doesn't come in with an agenda. She isn't secretly a Kamala Harris supporter or a Elizabeth Warren supporter. She's somebody who's about bringing folks in. And so once this primary gets over, once you get all 10, 12, 15, how many people get done, get weeded down to one, she's the person you want in there to bring everyone together and go after Trump.
I really think if the Democrats in Michigan are smart, and I think they are, I think, and with Gretchen Whitmer at the head of everything, I really think their positioning is going to be more moderate in terms of tone and everything else. I think that's the way to play it correctly between now and 2020. I think they're going to, as much as possible, be even-handed, at least come across that way at the top and as a party overall. I think that would be, again, for the reasons we've had. Remember, the last time there was a presidential election, Michigan went red. So I really think their approach has got to be a lot more middle of the road than a lot of progressives may like. But I think where possible, that is the way they're going to approach things.
Well, I can tell you that the person who got the most excitement, the loudest applause, I think, during the whole convention was Rashida Tlaib, which doesn't fit into your...
doesn't fit into what you're saying.
But that's who they reacted to. But that's, again, that's not what's going to be coming from the top down and from the party. I don't think there are going to be as many flamethrowers in the next 2 years. I could be wrong.
I disagree with you there, Jack, a little bit. We've already seen the new Attorney General and the new Secretary of State lob some pretty tough bombs at conservatives and Republicans, and it's only February 4th.
Well, I noticed you looking at your watch there. And then how does Gretchen Whitmer end up looking next to them?
Well, Gretchen is tied at the hip to her fellow Democrat women. And she's got to realize that, you know, for so long, Bill Schuette was labeled as Rick Snyder's attorney general, while Dana Nessel and Jocelyn Benson are going to be labeled as Gretchen Whitmer's attorney general and secretary of state. So they need to either work together or they're going to get picked off by moderate Michigan voters.
I think they'll work together, but I think the overall image, those two are new attorney general and secretary of state. I think what they do tends to make Gretchen Whitmer look more of a statesperson and more moderate.
Well, I can tell you that Lavora Barnes will not be the flamethrower. I can tell you that. She is more of a tactician. She is more results-oriented. She will leave, I believe, the flamethrowing to other people out there, and I don't think there's any shortage of them. Let's talk to Lavora Barnes after her victory as the next party chair. So I'm sitting here with Lavora Barnes, the new chair of the Michigan Democratic Party. First of all, congratulations on the win today.
Thank you very much.
So for people who don't know you, mm-hmm. and I know folks in the Democratic Party do, but for those who don't, tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I was just the chief operating officer of the party, which meant I did the day-to-day work of running the party, managing the staff, raising the money, managing the money, all of that sort of work. Before that, I worked for Lisa Brown, who is the clerk in Oakland County. I was her deputy clerk, helping her manage that staff and that budget. budget. Before that, I was a state director for the Obama campaign here in Michigan in 2012. And before that, I spent 6.5 years at the State House, where I was an organizer and then eventually a caucus director there.
So what can people expect from you as the next Michigan Democratic Party chair?
I think people will see us grow the work that we've started in 2017 and 2018 in terms of grassroots organizing. I believe strongly that the way we win elections is to get out in the field and have conversations with voters all year round, not just before the election. So this party is going to be on the doors and on the phones year round, cycle to cycle. We're not going to just do that in the election years.
How is this going to be hard this year with so many different candidates running for president? I think I counted 10 on the NPR site today. 18 more possibilities.
I know.
How do you bring this all together?
So here's what I know. Here's what I've learned. In 2018, we started the work of the One campaign before we had a nominee in August. We started early because you can have conversations with voters at the doors about why it's important to vote for Democrats, about the issues that are important to Democrats before you have a candidate to talk to. And then when you go back to talk to them about candidates, you reference those issues that you talked about at the door when you were there before. So that's the kind of work we're going to be doing leading up to 2020 while we're waiting for our presidential nominee to be chosen.
It seems like there's some of that already going on out there, and it's being funded by different individuals, billionaire out of California, Tom Steyer being one of them.
Yes.
Does that mean that the party loses some relevance?
Not at all. Like the work that we do supporting our county and local parties, we're here all the time. I appreciate the work that Tom Steyer and others are doing, but they're here because they have a goal, which is the same as our goal right now, 2020. But we're going to be here in 2021 and 2022. So if we don't build and strengthen this party now so that we're ready for the next cycle, when those folks aren't here because Michigan isn't their priority anymore, we'll still be here.
What is it that's exciting you about the Michigan Democratic Party? What gives you optimism that there can be success in 2020?
So much energy, right? So much energy. Like, I think it would have been very easy for people to be demoralized after 2016, but instead they strapped on their shoes and they got to work. And they're still very excited to get out there and do the work that we need to do. You saw this room. This was a good room of excited Democrats ready to go to work. And I'm thrilled that they've asked me to lead them in that, because I know that the way we win is to harness that enthusiasm into voter contact, talking to those voters.
Let's talk about the number of people here, because
yes.
I've been at these before where there's really been nothing on the ballot, nothing decided, and maybe you have a few hundred people here.
Yes.
And that's not what we had today.
No. We had thousands of people here, and this is becoming the way we do our conventions now. They've gotten quite big, and we're quite proud to try to host as many Democrats who want to be a part of this process as possible. It's a terrific thing.
All right. Anything else that you want to say going forward here?
No, here's the thing. We're going to get to work on Monday, right? I'm going to take a day and watch the Super Bowl, and then we're going to get to work on Monday, because we know that 2020 will be on us before we know it, and we've got to get to work right away.
Lavora Barnes, the new chair of the Michigan Democratic Party. Congratulations again.
Thank you very much.
Now, I did speak with Rashida Tlaib after the 13th Congressional District, where John Conyers made an appearance. That was very exciting, led in there by his son, who now had some frosted tips on the top. I guess that's a new thing now.
Are we going to see another Conyers running for that seat soon, Kyle?
I don't know. He looked very nice, but he didn't work the room like some of the other folks did. He basically led his father in there, and then he disappeared, and I don't know.
Who was working the room, Kyle? You just left the door open there.
There was plenty of other faces to be seen in the room, but John Conyers III came in during the middle and left before it ended. So unlike, let's say, Rashida Tlaib, who was there from the time that it started to, she may have been the last person out of the room. And I was one of the ones following her out, and you can hear that maybe in this conversation. We'll hit that. How'd this go here, your first congressional caucus that you've got to chair? They seem to love you.
I didn't get to chair it. I basically ran the election, made sure we got into the chair, and then allowed our new chair, Jonathan Kunlock, to proceed with the rest of it. Take care. Bye. I think it was really important to, I think even having our previous Congress member here was very lovely. It's, you know, to really set the environment of transitioning into this new era of civil rights movement, this new era of us really trying to engage more people in the 13th is important. And trying to unify, because this is such a diverse district from Detroit. Everybody only thinks it's just Detroit, but it's also Western Wayne and Downriver. And so I really wanted to be able to uplift a lot of the folks that are here. But it was, to me, was a process that I think is going to get better every time we try to do this together. And I'm going to be here to support my executive board members as much as I can. I mean, what I really want to focus on, though, is my youth advocate fellowship. So I'm going to raise $25,000 to have actual 25 youth representing each communities throughout the year to get involved in what's going on at their local government and state government, to getting more of our young people wanting to be involved in civically on all different levels of government. And it's something that I, you know, proposed to Jonathan. He loved the idea, and I think getting some of my other younger members of the 13 to get involved in recruiting, mentorship. It's important to engage another generation that really needs to understand how this stuff works. I think we've, you know, taken for granted people assume that young people are going to automatically get involved. And I said, no, we got to ask them to come to the table and let them understand how the process is. Ironically, Jonathan Kenlock said that's how he got involved in politics. His Congressman Crockett did the same thing. He had like a youth internship or some sort of program that was similar. So I'm really glad I told him, well, this is what I want to do. I don't want to just raise money for elections. I want to raise money for something that we can do year round.
So, tell me about the reaction you've gotten from your district after all the national publicity you've received.
Yeah, I mean, even before the orientation, I mean, right after the November election, it was all kinds of media attention. But I think many people know me before I was on the national stage, so they know who I was, and it wasn't, there wasn't like, oh my God, it was more of like, yep, that's Rashida. So I think there's, you know, many of my residents in the 13 voted for me because I was different. Many of them didn't vote for me because I was a first of anything. They really did elect me to be courageous, to push back against the right-wing agenda very aggressively. I think so many of us have seen, you know, people be a lot more silent on issues that we think, you know, should be talked about, especially impeaching this president. I think I've been very, you know, honest from the beginning, and I haven't wavered. And that's what I told them I wasn't going to do. So,
has this last month been really hard on you? I mean, with all the publicity you got, I'm sure you got a lot of negative feedback based on the response or the comments that you had made.
Not as much as at home.
Really?
No, the social, not at all. Almost as social. So I think social media is a different animal. It is something that brings people across the country onto your sites. And then I see my residents trying to defend me, you know, trying to, you know, calm everybody down. Like, you know, this person lives in California. They don't live in Michigan. They don't know who I am. And I think people are very protective of me. Some are obviously targeting because I'm Muslim. Some are targeting because I'm Arab. Some are targeting me because of my stance politically on certain issues. And some are targeting me because I cursed in public. But I think ultimately everybody that comes together, it's right-wing people that do not want this president impeached. And that is what's driving that kind of hate and force towards my direction, I think.
I heard you got some death threats.
Yeah, but that happened on day one after I won. I don't think people realize being Muslim in America is dangerous, especially somebody as public as I am. From getting on the first day of orientation, we had orientation right after the November election. First day was pulled aside, Capitol Police telling me that we have, you know, had to investigate a death threat that was very viable, but it was in a different state. Again, I was taken aback by that, but many of my colleagues, including Debbie Dingell and others, tell me that has happened to them before. And so I'm just leaning on a lot of them that have been in office before. You know, her stance on wanting gun reform has brought a lot of attention to her, and she had to deal with that as well. But you know, tremendous amount of support, and I feel very safe in my district. But it's the national, nationally, it's very evident that hate and those that promote violence are very, very upset that there is a Muslim American in Congress. From everything coming down, it's all traced to the fact that I'm Muslim.
And so the reception that you've gotten here in the district, that's got to be very reassuring to you then.
Yeah, I mean, before I ran, I did an exploratory committee. I wanted to make sure, you know, are they okay with a Congress member that will block trucks so they can have a right to breathe? Are they going to be okay with a Congress member that wants to impeach the president? Are they going to be okay with the fact that, you know, I am going to be one of those that even if the Democratic Party might not be in support of something, especially around environmental justice, especially around the health care crisis, are they going to be okay because I'm going to probably stand out and say, you know, don't sell us out. You need to do the right thing. And overwhelmingly, that's what people wanted. If you hear many of the conversations that people say, you know, even if they can't pronounce my name, they're like, but that's the girl that we know exactly what we're going to get with her. And that she's never going to back down. And that's what they wanted, and that's what they got.
You got the president to say, basically acknowledge you in a press conference. That's got to be kind of cool. Your first, basically.
No, it's not cool.
It's not cool?
No.
It wasn't cool. Okay.
I can tell you, you know, I think for me, you know, people need to remember, I mean, I think I was with every other woman, I think, across the country when he won, felt this sense of not belonging, the sense of feeling less than immediately, because the people that elected him, people that voted for him, said it's okay that he said the things that he said about Muslims or Mexicans or women. And so that is, you know, and I think that for me, as I'm coming in here, just as just a fellow human being, a fellow American, you know, I'm just taken aback by how aggressive that hate agenda has become. And, you know, now I'm obviously on the national stage and I've become a target of theirs. But it's very evident that it's all people that have supported his hatred, some of his racist comments. Many that call the office is very specific, and it's very targeted about me being Muslim. A lot of them will say, well, we don't want you to impeach. He's the best president. Plus, you should get out of our country. And it's like, what kind of, this is my country. I'm not going anywhere.
What's it been like being on the national stage?
Look, I'm always very zero focused on the community, and the work that I do is always reflective of what I'm hearing from my residents. You know, the issues I'm working on from the first oversight committee around high cost of prescription drugs, I focused on the high cost of insulin. I understand now that everything that I'm going to do in fighting for my residents is more now on a national stage, but I'm going to use this opportunity to elevate their voices. I know now that from my strong stance against this president, the fact that, you know, being one of the first firsts in Congress sets a stage that I need to use to better the quality of life of my residents. And that's what I'm going to use it as a resource to make sure that they feel like they're heard.
Has anybody come up to you and said, yeah, way to go, way to call him a motherfucker?
All day here. Thank you. No, really. I was like, whoa, shit, that person curses. I did a podcast, I think it was like 3 months ago, and it was great. It was about women running for office, and it was about, talking about me being a product of Detroit Public Schools and some of my upbringing and some of the passions I have around reducing, you know, discrimination for car insurance and increasing home ownership, all these things. And at the end, you know, the interviewer is a woman and a man. Said, is there anything that, what did he say? He said, oh, is there anything that people don't know about you? And I said, well, a lot of people don't know. I kind of curse like a trucker. Well, it's funny. I said, he's like, well, now everybody knows, but it was months ago. But I can tell you, you know, my passion sometimes gets the best of me, but sometimes I feel like it does result in uplifting a lot of what my residents feel right now. And one of my seasoned residents said to me, you know, Rashida, I would never use that word, but you saying it, I felt liberated. I felt more freer for some reason hearing my member of Congress say something that I'm feeling. She said, immediately I just felt like, okay, finally someone's going to stand up to him.
So you don't regret it?
I regret the distraction it caused. But that's who I was at the moment. I'm not going to apologize for that.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to Jacob, Andrew Bitely for coming in, Jack and Mike, and also the Democratic Party for their hospitality on Saturday. All right, so if you didn't watch the Super Bowl, Mike, what on earth did you watch? What else is there to watch?
I was watching reruns of Supernatural. I think season 11 is where I'm at right now.
When's the last time you watched a Super Bowl?
Oh, it's been years. I used to watch when my son was in middle school, and we'd bet a Baby Ruth, and that was a big deal.
Do you remember the last game that you saw?
No.
When was your last game? I know you know, Jack.
Yeah, the last full Super Bowl that I didn't watch it, I listened to it, was the Buffalo Giants game, because I was on the road.
That was 1991.
Yes, but I've made no secret of the fact.
I was in high school, Jack.
I stopped. I do not like the NFL. I stopped liking the NFL a long time ago.
All right, so how many minutes of the Super Bowl did you watch, Jacob? You even threw a frickin' party.
Oh, yeah. Well, I feel like I'm becoming one of those, like, mainstream football watchers where I have a party with the Super Bowl on, but it's all about making cocktails for my friends here.
So the most memorable moment for you was the Washington Post ad.
Oh yeah, that was pretty cool. And we also watched the halftime show where we got to watch Adam Levine do his thing and
take his shirt off, and you feel kind of like strange about the whole deal.
Yeah, yeah. There was an weird audible reaction in my house. People weren't ready for that.
Now compare that to the excitement I had at home watching a YouTube presentation on how to grow wild mushrooms in coffee grounds. Which was absolutely amazing. It was hilarious because the guy did it. He shows the price in the store of the wild mushrooms, and so he's going to grow them at home to save money, and he ends up with humidifiers going and tarp covering everything, and he had to spend 20 times more money just setting himself up to do it.
I got to give you some credit, Jack. There's way less chances to be scandalized watching something like that.
Yeah, I thought it was wonderful. I'm not going to attempt it. It showed me not to try it, is what it told me.
Life with Jack Spencer, Andrea. I hope your Super Bowl Sunday was more exciting. Most.
No? I watched the Big Block of Cheese episode of The West Wing.
You didn't.
The only people could see in Kyle's face as he.
Kyle's cringing very hard at the moment at all of our responses to our Super Bowl experience.
The biggest sporting event of the year, and Andrew's watching cheese.
Is it baseball season yet?
Oh. Kyle's mad that we're not, you know, fulfilling our American duty to watch the Super Bowl. But I think this is a good representation of America. Watching whatever you want, anytime you want, on YouTube.
Or Netflix.
All right, I'm going to stop before I get even more depressed, as if the Michigan State-Indiana game didn't put me in that mood anyway. Until next week, thank you, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.